Connect the Dots with Allison Rose Levy, Saturdays at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Saturday at noon on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a Huffington Post blogger, a 20-year health journalist, and connect the dots between our personal health and our total health and environment. That means the health of the earth we live in, the health of the society we live in, the health of the community we live in, as well as our own personal health. Every week on this show, we have exciting thought leaders and activists to help you take action to participating in protecting the health of our society, our world, and all of us. On today's show, I have a really terrific guest that's been part of a sort of wonderful trifecta of people that I've had on in the last couple of weeks talking about fracking and gas drilling, which is kind of reaching a pitch in terms of whether or not the decision is made to bring it into New York State, which many, many impose. So I have a couple of stories for you on that this week, as well as our guest. First, let's turn to some exciting actions and events this week. A big action on Tuesday, that's this coming Tuesday, December 6th, is being organized by Water Defense. It's called Water for Dimmick. This is a small town in Pennsylvania who lost their water supply 3 years ago due to gas drilling contamination. The company responsible was legally bound by their contracts, as well as agreed and promised the state and the citizens that they would supply and pipeline water in. They reneged on that promise. The state of Pennsylvania never followed up. They've been trucking water in ever since then to the town citizens, and they are basically stopping that now. So there's a big action being organized by Mark Ruffalo and Water Defense. And you can find out more about how you can get involved by going to waterdefense.org. Very important action. We'll be talking about that more on today's show. The second big event of this week that I wanted to draw your attention to is especially for New York residents, but it will actually be touring nationwide. And that is the debut of a wonderful new film called The Big Fix. This was executive produced by Tim Robbins, and it's about the cover-up of ongoing environmental and health contamination in the wake of the horrible Gulf oil spill and incident, which, even though it may have slipped from our awareness, has not stopped happening. The filmmakers will be joining me as guests on the show in the very near future, and if you're a New York resident, there's really an exciting opportunity to participate in 7 days of awareness. The film will be screening at the AMC Lowe's Theater in downtown New York, and every night of the week there are going to be different activist leaders and groups participating in panel discussions with the filmmakers after the film. I am definitely going to be there. I can promise you that. It's a great lineup. To find out more about the film and to go to the screenings and find out who's speaking, you can go online to thebigfixmovie.com. Highly, highly recommended. And also, listeners who want to tune in when I have the filmmakers on can sign up for my e-zine, healthjournalistblog.com, and every week right before this show, once a week only, you get an e-zine with links to the current radio broadcast as well as my current blogs and action links like the ones you just heard, and those are all in the e-zine every week as well. Last week, we were speaking about the upcoming hearing of the Department of Environmental Conservation that was going to take place in New York City, and I had Sandra Steingraber on the show, and we really tried to get people out to participate in this. Well, it's been a very exciting week in terms of what happened there that we'll talk about more in today's show with our guest. And also, I want to clue listeners in that I have a blog up on the Huffington Post today about that extraordinary event. We'll talk about it more in the show, but you can also read my blog on Huffington Post Green. Amazingly, I had originally been told, I reported live at the event, I was there for the entire event in the press conference, and the DEC press people had originally told me that 2,000 people were there. Well, it turned out that 6,000 showed up. So, you know, we're really turning a corner on more and more people understanding, getting involved, and really making a big impact, because this is something that our leaders have to listen to. And that brings me to my guest today. He was one of the speakers at the DEC meeting. He's been what I call a new breed of tireless activist organizers, and he is truly tireless, and seems to be everywhere almost at every time. He's one of the busiest people I know, and yet is still an absolute sweetheart and very beloved in the environmental community, and that is David Braun of United for Action. So I want to welcome you to today's Connect Dots, David. So glad to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me, Allison.
David, you know, you are very involved with United for Action. You're involved with Gasland Movie. You've also been involved with helping NYU students and the younger generation get on board with this issue, and it is becoming a powerful kind of youth movement. How did you get involved? How did you, what kind of prompted you to participate? And, you know, tell us a little bit about the origins of involvement.
Sure. So I have been an activist working on social justice, environmental justice, and other issues for a number of years. And I was working with MoveOn.org and was running the Manhattan Council system. Had a number of activists in the group really wanted to work on the issue of hydraulic fracturing. And so we had a rally in Union Square, and we had teamed up with the folks over at NYH2O to do the rally. So it was a MoveOn NYH2O rally, and we had some really great speakers there. And Al Appleton, the former DEP commissioner for the city of New York, came and spoke, as well as several others, and it was a very successful event. And afterwards, we basically turned to ourselves and said, you know, where do we go from here? So we tried to give a nudge to our friends at MoveOn to see if they would maybe engage in the hydrofracking issue, which we all considered to be a really critical issue. And they didn't really want to work on it. They didn't feel it was a national issue, even though it was going on in 34 states and had immense implications on our energy policy, in that they're trying to switch basically a lot of the good portion of the United States, our power plants, our vehicles, and everything else to run on natural gas. But because they didn't feel that it was something critical as we did, we decided to look to engage with the issue on another level. And so many of us from MoveOn and some folks that were working for at that time for Obama for America decided to form United for Action. And that was about a year and a half ago, a little over a year and a half ago. And as a result, United for Action came about. And we started out basically just trying to do education, just trying to get out and put the word out about what was going on. And then it just evolved, and we kind of found ourselves in the middle of this, you know, big movement to stop hydraulic fracturing and the poisoning of our water and land and the environment and the people. And so I got into it that way. And then I knew Josh Fox, the director of Gasland, just from the work that we were doing and some screenings that we had done. And so I got a call from him last winter, saying, hey, I want you to come and work with the movie Gasland and help with the grassroots screenings, and then, you know, help me with some other things and help direct this grassroots campaign that's going on around this film. And, of course, I jumped at the chance because I've never, ever seen a film have such a great social impact in terms of raising awareness and what it's done for a movement. So it was kind of a no-brainer for me to jump onto that. And then I just found myself liaisoning very well with a lot of the organizations that work on this issue, and just getting kind of involved deeper and deeper. And I guess that's one of the wonderful things about working on this issue, if there is one, which is that this issue is such a kind of a, I don't know, it's a little bit an impending doom and gloom because the oil and gas industry has so much money. But the flip side of it is that there are so many people who I have never seen activists so engaged, and people who never were activists before becoming activists, and engaged on such a level, with such great passion, with such big hearts, and engaging to, you know, really try and protect our water and move us towards, you know, a renewable energy economy. And that's really the silver lining, because I get to work with such amazing, beautiful, wonderful, caring individuals who really believe that we can take the world in a different direction and aren't, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid that, you know, we have to poison ourselves for our energy. And I think that's a really profound thing. And it's a beautiful thing to be able to stand up with so many wonderful, big-hearted folks and try and bring this change about.
So. You know, that really, you're really capturing something I think is really crucial and very little discussed. And that is, you know, I think that back in the day, you know, in the 60s, activism got a bad name. It got a bad jacket because of the violence which erupted, mostly instigated by, you know, police and enforcement officials. It came about, you know, the people reacted and activism became tied in the public mind with anger. These activists are so angry. Actually, you know, and then it was considered, you know, spiritual to sort of, you know, be calm and detached from anything that might be going on in the world. And I think we really had and are in the middle of having a profound wake-up call about how untenable that is as a solution to the current world crises. And even Deepak Chopra, who's been on this show and who I have worked with, you know, is now really saying, you know, we have to save and protect our world. We're not going to just sit back here. But along the way, I wrote a piece about 2 years ago about the power of activism as a spiritual act, really, that was in the Huffington Post. And the thing it's one thing to sort of have a lot of suppressed anger because you're sort of being polite, but you don't like what's going on, or deaden yourself with antidepressants or whatever. I'm a health journalist, so I think about, you know, the total package of how people take care of themselves and their stress. And it's another thing to constructively channel your energy in a positive way with a community of people and really participate. And I think one of the things that those who do it, who go to Occupy Wall Street, where I'm going tomorrow for a farmers march to protect our food, happening at 2 p.m., another action people can get involved with if you care about food, you know, one of the things that happens is it's actually uplifting. This is a great group of people. I mean, I love that you said that. There's so much heart there. So it's not angry actually at all. It's kind of using energy constructively and in community. You know, we don't have to win this one by one by one. We can all do this together. Now, that brings me to the DEC meeting, and you gave a beautiful and powerful testimony on that. You know, were you expecting, was the community of organizers expecting as many as 6,000 people to turn out? I mean, what does that number tell us about the concern about this issue?
Well, you know, I mean, that's definitely a very clear indication of that people are fed up, that they've had enough of the oil and gas industry deciding our energy policy and basically making us be the canary in the coal mine. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, turning out in numbers that, you know, we haven't seen before. And, you know, just to speak to, you know, what you were just mentioning, I think that people are, it's one thing just to say, hey, this is a really bad thing. And, you know, and that's saying something. So there is some power in that. But when you actually do something that is consistent with what you're saying shouldn't happen, or what you have objections to, and you actually take action that is consistent with what it is you're saying, well, then that becomes a whole other thing. That becomes realization. It becomes realization and demonstration of your passion or your words or your objections. And there's a lot of power in that. And this movement is something that, you know, when you get 6,000 people turning out to these hearings, that it's clearly there's a community of people who are standing up to say, I am being realized, and I need to have my voice realized, and I'm no longer going to allow the financial needs of a particular industry that has demonstrated time and time again no concern for the people in the communities where they're doing the drilling. And I am going to put a stop to it. And there's just immense power in that, and it's a really just a very special thing to be a part of at this time. I think it's very historic.
So you're saying the group that is coming together is making history because, in effect, trying to turn the tides of history. We are at a choice point where it could go down one road, toward environmental degradation, health problems, which, you know, are being detailed, or it could go another direction where people really take back their power and recreate a society that is more in line with their hopes and dreams and values.
Well, let's make no mistake. This is going down the road to complete degradation of our environment, of our air, of our water. In each one of these wells, they use 400,000 pounds of toxic chemicals, 50% of which can cause cancer, 50% of which are endocrine disruptors, 50% of which are immune suppressants. And that's all in the DEP report that was created by the city of New York. So this is happening, and it's not just with fracking. It's happening with deep water drilling, which is, you know, what this movie is about, that you mentioned, the big fix that's happening tonight and for the rest of the week here in New York City. But it's also happening with the tar sands. It's also happening, you know, even with the nuclear that's going on and what we're seeing in Fukushima, that these forms of extracting energy are literally killing us. And we are at a point where this is the civil rights fight of our time, where these corporations that have financial interests are, making our decisions in regards to our energy policy. And if I may, there was an article that came out in the Wall Street Journal last February that talked about how Exxon was all out of oil, that they have drilled all of their easily accessible oil reserves. And because of this, they need to diversify their business because they're essentially running out of their main product. So they purchased a company called XTO, which is a big gas drilling company. Well, then we know that Chevron followed suit and purchased Atlas, which is another big gas drilling company doing hydraulic fracturing. BP has followed suit. Shell has followed suit. ConocoPhillips has followed suit. So all of these big oil and gas companies are now focusing, putting their sights on hydraulic fracturing. And so then you see a concerted effort by T. Boone Pickens to start running our heavy trucks on natural gas and to build out all these pipelines and filling stations and running cars on natural gas and 150 new power plants going in all across the United States. And they want to build all this out so we will be then shackled to this technology of hydraulic fracturing, which is a really frightening and scary thought. But it's really being pushed forward by the oil and gas industry. I mean, the American Petroleum Institute, just a few weeks ago, spent $20 million in hiring a new PR firm to push hydraulic fracturing and natural gas. Whereas, we just heard in the General Electric just announced, who's been doing extensive research and development of solar energy, has just announced that within 5 years, the power that we get from solar energy is going to be less expensive than the power that we get from fossil fuels. So if we know this, in 5 years is a very short period of time, it would be foolish for us to build out such an extensive infrastructure that's surrounding what is already obsolete drilling practice and form of getting our energy. So, you know, when you put up a $1.4 billion power plant that's running on natural gas, that's anything but a quote-unquote transitional fuel. That is a very permanent choice and is one that they're going to want to reap rewards from. And these are really big energy policy decisions that are being made, that is being pushed by a very deep-pocketed industry that is making decisions for the people, and the people have had enough. The people are finally saying, no, it looks like we're heading in that direction, but we're not going to let you do it. And it's very profound to see this movement rise up, because this is the critical fight. If we don't engage in this fight, our children, our children's children, and generations to come will not know clean water, will not know clean air, will not know this beautiful, amazing world that we've been given. And that's why this fight is so critical, and I think that's why people are standing up in numbers that we've never seen before.
You know what? I think it's very helpful to hear the larger context for this choice, because people are busy. They're not energy experts. They hear transitional independence, and then they're kind of like, the government must, kind of be looking out for our health, and they must know whether this is safe or not. And then they kind of figure, hey, we need energy, and they go along with it. They don't realize that they have been programmed by mass PR campaign. And the other piece of this, you mentioned the health piece, and last week on the show we had Sandra Steingraber, the author of Raising Elijah, and she's an ecologist and a biologist, and as I am, a 25-year health journalist, and so we really had quite the conversation about health and the health impacts. And one of the most frequently mentioned things among the comments of people during this, you know, exhaustive session where the public finally had an opportunity in New York City to speak to the Department of Environmental Conservation and give their input. And one of the most frequent comments heard was that they are ready to put forth, and I think it's very important for all New York residents and other areas facing fracking to understand that the state here, and it's the same kind of thing that happened in Pennsylvania, they're ready to roll forward. They're trying to push forward and do the fracking. These guidelines that everyone was commenting on are the ones that are going to govern how it's done. And I want to talk a little bit more in depth with you about that. But the bottom line is, they said, we're ready to go. We've done the assessment. This is it. And just tell us what you think, guys, kind of thing, in 3 minutes apiece. And meanwhile, there is no health assessment in there. So the state, which, you know, most of us would think, well, they're looking out for us. Well, they never even looked at health. They made no assessment about health, even though there have been wide reports from doctors and people showing up with the same syndrome of health issues, which is also the same syndrome of health issues seen in the Gulf area, seen in areas where there's tar sands contamination. And that's what the big fix is about. These same health syndromes show up time and again when we have the combination of this oil and gas and all these toxic chemicals that are used to move and control them, which is what is the process of fracking is about. And yet the state says, we're ready to go, and they never looked into health. 250 doctors stood up and said, please wait and look at this, and they want to push forward. So I asked you, where is the impetus coming from to move forward and say that we've got it covered when they haven't even looked into health? What's the hurry there on the part of the state which we think is protecting us?
Well, and that's the curious thing. You know, you hit on the health impacts. And the other thing that isn't in these this environmental impact statement is that the jobs lost is also not being considered at all. That they were very, very specific of their analysis of the jobs that would be won. And, of course, the DEC received this information from the industry. But they did no research on jobs that will be lost. And when you put 100,000 gas wells into New York State and you have 1,200 truck trips, heavy trucks on the roads, you have a major industrialization of the landscape. It's going to kill our tourism. It will poison our water in certain places. It will have adverse health impacts, but also that reflects in many other industries, such as, say, wine making, beer making, our food shed, countless other jobs that it will hurt. It will have a detrimental effect on our state economy, especially a state that is so based on tourism. Basically what these proposed environmental impact statement is doing is it's negotiating levels of Dante's Inferno. That do we want to settle on level 4 or level 5? You know, but as long as they're doing hydraulic fracturing, there will be adverse effects. There is no way they can fix all of the problems, One of the things I often say is that there are hundreds of reasons not to do hydraulic fracturing, any one of which would be sufficient reason in and of itself not to do hydraulic fracturing. But we don't just have one of those reasons, you know. We don't just have five. We have hundreds. And they're never going to fix them all. And this is a very, very flawed document. As you mentioned, the health impacts, that would be one of the very, very critical considerations, as everywhere they have done this, there has been adverse health impacts. And I think it's very arrogant of the DEC to somehow think that they're going to be able to dodge the bullet on this one. Because everywhere else it's been done, it has not been able to be done safely. And, you know, Josh Fox has consistently said to the industry, show me a place where you have 100 wells and no adverse impacts, and I'll go there. And the industry has yet to take him up on his offer because it just doesn't exist. So the other thing that I think is critical to mention with this is that, you know, you asked me what's the big push about? Well, the big push is that, you know, Governor Cuomo, I don't think, wants to be seen as not bringing in jobs in a bad economy. But I have to counter that by saying there are certain things that we have agreed as a society are not good for us. Like, for instance, crack cocaine, right? Why don't we sell crack cocaine and make it and make money off of it? Well, because it's bad for the people. Right? It gets people strung out, it hurts them, it breaks up their families. There's all a whole host of problems with this. So we've decided as a society that this is not a good thing for the people. Well, unfortunately, you know, I would have to say that fracking is very much the same thing as crack, that it's bad for the people. The only difference is that we have these major industry with very deep pockets that keeps spending tons of money on PR and buying off our politicians. And so there's this giant push to actually drill it. But I would put this on the same level of, you know, anything else that we'd be damaging that we should not be making money off. And, you know, the thing that's critical with this as well is that you can see that the DEC is trying to push this forward at a breakneck speed because, A, they're not including a lot of really critical studies, information, reports that would be contrary to what their agenda is, such as I had a conversation with Tony Ingraffia, who's a renowned scientist at Cornell University and is a specialist in fracking technologies. And he told me that he keeps delivering reports and information to the DEC, which they keep omitting from their environmental impact statement and their analysis that they're doing. The other thing is that they have created regulations, proposed regulations, for drilling before they've even finalized their environmental impact statement. Now, the finalized environmental impact statement should influence those regulations. But the fact that they've released them both at the same time is putting the cart before the horse. And it's a clear indication that they're trying to move forward at a breakneck speed, and they're obviously not considering whether this should even be done in the first place. They keep saying, well, how are we going to do it? What is the regulatory structure that we're going to do it under? And, you know, kind of how can we cut corners in order to do this? But the real question is why would we want to do it in the first place? Why is this a good thing for the people? Why is this a good thing for the state? And that's a fundamental question that is not being asked. And the people are stepping up and making so much noise because that is the question that we need to have answered before any of this can go forward.
It just seems, why would they're pushing it because they feel they need jobs and everything. But according to some of the comments, and this was not just by average citizens, but this was by speaking at the DEC was a risk a management professional who ran through a whole long list of different downside risks. And these are not just wild risks that you should, you know, that are kind of wild-eyed or crazy. These are standard things that would be included in any major assessment or any kind of billion-dollar infrastructure investment, as we saw, we've seen with Enron, as we've seen with the banking and mortgage crisis, you know, investments can go wrong. Wall Street can push something, go out on a limb, and take all of us with it. And it's therefore very appropriate, not only because of the thousands of anecdotal incidents of damage, harm, contamination, death, and everything that has resulted, but even from an economic point of view, if the situation goes bust, we need to know who is bearing the cost, what those costs are, and where are all of the legal barriers and protections that transfer the risk back onto the companies who were profiting and investing in this rather than onto the taxpayer. And she was pointing out that there's hardly any of that in the document. I was shocked by that. That means that not only could we have health problems, not only could this harm industries, not only could it change the entire character of New York State, impact our food supply, but it also means we, at the end of the day, we could be left with a whopping bill.
Right. Right. Well, and that's an interesting thing. I mean, the New York Times article that recently came out called this a widget industry. And I think that what they didn't mean that they were selling widgets, but it was more in the sense that that they have a certain bottom line, they meaning the industry, has a certain bottom line in terms of what they need to make in terms of money. And it all comes down to expenses and costs incurred. And so the more they can keep their costs down, the better off they are. And so it's in terms of, you know, making profit. So it's in their best interest to make sure that, for instance, right now there isn't a real solid way of what are they going to do with the hazardous fracking wastewater. Well, there really isn't any way to treat this water safely. But meanwhile, they're about to license a practice which is going to create millions and millions of gallons of toxic, radioactive, hazardous wastewater, and they don't have a contingency plan on what's going to happen to it. And that's, you know, a direct result of an industry that is concerned with just making money. And they realize that this wastewater is a major problem, and it's in their best interest to just make sure that it's not addressed. However, you know, the downside of it is that this is a tragedy in the making. You know, there's been talk of the poisoning of Dunkard Creek, which was something like, what, a 42-mile-long stretch of a creek that was killed. That, you know, all fingers are pointing to the fracking wastewater poisoning it. And I, last year alone in Pennsylvania, 62 million gallons of fracking wastewater just went missing.
Oh,
they don't
my.
Know what happened to it. You know, it just wasn't tracked. And so what was done with that? Where was it dumped? Now, here is a widget industry that doesn't care, that's sole concern is wanting to make money. And to have to deal with this fracking wastewater that is toxic, hazardous, radioactive wastewater that isn't being classified as this because of all the exemptions in the you know, the Safe Drinking Water Act and our national laws, unfortunately. But when they have to deal with such a costly enterprise of dealing with this waste product, they're just going to try and deal with it in the most efficient way for them, which is to get rid of it in a way in the middle of the night or whenever it is, so that they don't actually have to, you know, have incurred any more costs. It's frightening. Truly, truly frightening.
Yeah, this is a case where, you know, the bottom line considerations are really every time a bottom line consideration interferes, it's not just, oh, we saved the bottom line, that means we're going to do economically better. That comes out of somewhere. And my concern, because of my background reporting on health, is that it's coming out of our health. Now, let's take a break for station identification, and we'll be back to discuss this more, as well as upcoming action opportunities that people can participate in. I'm speaking with David Braun of United for Action. We're talking about fracking and the recent DEC meetings, and so please stay with us, listeners. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and this is Connect the Dots. Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every noon on Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. We're moving forward, and that means connecting the dots. We have to pick up our heads from our individual lives and take a look at the health of our society, take action, and join in community with others to protect our health, our air, our water, our food, and our earth, as well as the health of our society, its humanity, its caring, its values. My guest on today's show is David Braun of United for Action. He's a tireless organizer and a terrific advocate and spokesperson for water protection, very knowledgeable. I'll be back with him in just 1 minute. I wanted to alert all listeners to my current blog on the Huffington Post, which you can find on HuffPost Green. You can search it by going Huffington plus Allison Rose Levy. I would love my listeners to follow me on Huffington, because the more followers, the more we get these issues before the eyes of a broad readership on the Huffington Post, and more people become active and aware. And you'll also find details and testimony and the voice of the people at the recent DEC hearing, as well as many legislators and policymakers who really are also recognizing the problem. We're not just a kind of group of anti-this or anti-that. A lot of public officials, many in New York City, are very, very concerned about this, as they should be, and are as highly critical of it as the grassroots community has been. In the last segment with David Braun, we were just talking about the fact, David brought up that, you know, there are no plans in the guidelines that New York State has put forth to go ahead with fracking in New York State. There is no provision for the management of, you know, hundreds of thousands of gallons of wastewater contaminated with highly hazardous industrial chemicals, carcinogens and neurotoxins. And just in the last couple of days was another instance, and there are many, many, many that I have seen passed along to me by the grassroots friends that I have on Facebook, about a guy dumping 800 gallons of fracking fluid just in the middle of nowhere. So, you know, just to get rid of it to save a corporation, you know, a couple of bucks is just exactly, David, as you were mentioning. You know, so this isn't just a one-time thing. This is something that happens over and over. And, you know, if people are dumping, if, you know, who are subcontractors or hired by companies who are cutting corners, these are just the kinds of cutting of corners that created the Gulf Oil incident, you know, which has been an ongoing problem. So is this the thing that amazes me, David, and bringing David Braun back in here now, is that there aren't like 100,000 people who were concerned about this and showing up at that meeting this past week.
Well, you know, I think that, again, you know, just to reference my earlier comment about the $20 million that the gas industry American Petroleum Institute just gave to a PR firm, you know, they've been very clever in their messaging, saying that, you know, natural gas is clean burning, that this is, you know, a harmless process. And they've been able to be successful for a number of different reasons, because A, they're spending so much money and buying off our elected officials, and our elected officials need money to, you know, be elected and to, you know, run for office. Unfortunately, things like the Bob Howard study from Cornell University, which tells us, you know, because one of the claims of the gas industry is that it's cleaner, that natural gas is cleaner burning. And they're absolutely right that it is a cleaner burning fuel. But when you take into full consideration the full life cycle of hydraulic fracturing, meaning all of those 1,200 truck trips, the heavy truck trips going to and from the well, when you take into consideration the methane seepage, which Haworth and his peers who reviewed the study consider conservatively to be about 3 to 6%, and then when you take into consideration the combustion as well, that when you take into consideration all of those factors, that what they have found, because this methane seepage of 3 to 6%, methane has about, I think, 23 times more greenhouse gases than carbon dioxide. So it has that much more an effect on our atmosphere and on global warming and on climate change. That what they found is that hydraulic natural gas that is drilled and extracted by hydraulic fracturing is actually 20% dirtier than coal over a 20-year period, and it's on par with coal over a 100-year period. And unfortunately, that information has not gotten out to the people, which is a real shame. Also, there are so many landowners right now that need help and need assistance, they've essentially been bought off. And you have these people in all of these areas where they can do drilling, the southern tier of New York and Pennsylvania, who stand to get rich. And, you know, we all know what it's like to, you know, have that incentive of, you know, some of these folks could earn several million dollars off property that they really can't do a whole lot or aren't doing a whole lot with because there isn't, you know, a sustainable way of, you know, of farming and bringing this food in because of the food prices are not what they could be for people to actually make money off of this doing farming. So you have these folks that own this land who want to strike it rich, and they become a big portion of the lobby to see this happen. The downside of it is in all of this is that it's a pipe dream for a lot of these folks. You know, the one of the recent articles that did come out in the New York Times was talking about how Range Resources, who's drilling in Pennsylvania, has the article focused on basically on two cousins, and you know, one of the cousins is striking it rich, and well, they both were making money off the gas drilling. One's water has not been poisoned, and so he's very gung-ho and is, you know, talking about all the great things about this practice because he's striking it rich. And then the other cousins basically had to move off of her property, and her family's getting sick, and she's getting sick, and her kids are getting nosebleeds, and she has to drive 50 miles to and from her property every day just so she can feed her animals. And you know, she has many, many animals that she raises on her property, and you know, she's experienced a number of stillbirths and animals dying. And you get to see the picture painted of what this is all about. Now, I think this is all interesting in that when we did rally at the Shale Gas Insight conference that took place in early September in Philadelphia, I had a chance to speak with a driller when I was there. And this driller was telling me, basically, he was a gentleman that worked for Range Resources, and he was telling me about how when he used to work as a regulator, that his kids would laugh at him because he wasn't able to afford to pay all of his bills. So his cable bill, his cable would get shut off, and his children would laugh at him because he wasn't able to pay. And so he was touting to me how he's now able to, you know, have not only just basic cable, but every channel he wants, and that he's doing very well. And then he went on to tell me, you know, how Range Resources is doing this differently, how they're, you know, they really take all the steps that they possibly can to try and keep people safe and their water safe, and there's no company that's doing it as well as Range Resources. Well, I'd like to highlight the fact that, and I understand, and I feel with this guy. I mean, it was a great conversation, and the guy was a very sweet, nice guy and was, you know, a human being, and I want to see him have a job. But I'd like to highlight that it's Range Resources that's doing the drilling in that area in Pennsylvania, which was just highlighted in the New York Times article, where this woman has had to move off her land. And so if this is the company that can do it the most safely, as per this individual, this driller that I spoke with, then it's really never going to be good enough.
Well, that's a really excellent point, you know, and the other thing, too, is that I think that people have to develop more media literacy, and I say this as someone who's been in the media for 25 years, and so, you know, if you're seeing an ad going that cost $1 million and another couple of million to buy the TV time and everything, then what you're actually seeing is an ad for promoting a fantasy that's helping the 1%, but may have all kinds of, you know, all of the things that we're talking about are harmful downside effects of the 99%. So what you have is people in a society, an economic crisis as ours is, scratching to get into, be part of that 1%. This may be my only shot. Otherwise, I'm going to wind up here in the 99%. But there's a real ethical and moral breakdown, you know, and yet it's a human instinct to try to survive. But, you know, we have to point out it's at the expense of the 99% and all these other people. So, you know, everyone may have the fantasy or hope that they will be exempted and they'll be in the 1%. But you know, if climate change continues as it has been going, we're all going to be in the 100% when it comes to planet Earth. And if we dwell in New York, unless we have the resources to go off and live in Samoa, although actually climate change is also affecting Pacific Islands and stuff like that, you know, there is no real exemption here. Now, I just wanted to briefly, one of the things that really struck me, which I hope maybe, especially as you've been talking with Dr. Graffia, and we have only about another 9 or so minutes on the show, David, is, you know, one of the things that I quoted you as saying in the current Huffington blog is that you called the ability or the thought of how to protect the New York City water supply that is proposed by Governor Cuomo in these environmental guidelines, you characterize them as inept and, you know, ineffective. In other words, it's a mask on a situation, but it's not going to really work. Do you have any, without getting into the buffer zone and all of that, which is fairly complex, do you have any basic insights why people living downstream are also going to feel the impact? And it's not just, you know, oh, these poor people upstate, whatever, too bad for them. We'll just grow our gardens and eat off of our rooftops down in New York City.
Sure. Well, I mean, one thing that they'll, you know, again, like I said, there are hundreds of reasons not to do this practice, and they're never going to be able to fix all of them because they're just not, it's just not possible. And I would say one of the key ones would be even the air impacts. So you have all of these truck trips that basically every 7,700 wells equals the air pollution of a Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas. And we can see that this is true because last year, Wyoming had worse air pollution in a state that has the occupancy of one person per square mile, had worse air pollution than the city of Los Angeles. Now, that says something. Now, so if we know that every 7,700 wells creates the air pollution of a Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, and they want to put in 100,000 wells in New York State, you're looking at something like, you know, 11, 12, 13, 14 Dallas-Fort Worth, Texases going in upstate New York. Well, all of that air pollution will not only drift down towards the city, but the volatile organic compounds and the other things that are vented off of these gas wells and these compressor stations also evaporates into the air. And, of course, we know that precipitation likes to pick up whatever's in the air and rain it back down. So all of this can go drifting over our watershed, be rained into our reservoirs, and then will also come drifting down into New York City, where they estimate that 3,000 people a year are dying because of air pollution. Now, that's one thing that they never are going to be able to fix. And there's hundreds of others, as well. The Al Appleton, the former DEP commissioner, has said that it's ludicrous that they're going to be allowing drilling to go on underneath our aqueducts that bring our water into New York City, and that we could lose 50% of our water supply from an explosion or from some other sort of problem that may arise within 24 hours. 50% of our water in 24 hours for this drilling practice. There's too many problems with this document and with this practice that just put the people at risk. And they're just never going to be able to fix them all. So there's a couple.
Well, that's terrific. It's not terrific, but I mean, I think that's really a great cautionary tale. As we're coming down to the last couple of minutes of the show, David, just want to briefly highlight that there's actually an entire town in Pennsylvania that has lost its water. We only have a couple of minutes, but I know you'll be heading up there next week. Can you just tell our listeners briefly a little bit about that?
Sure. So what we're doing is we're teaming up with Josh Fox, Mark Ruffalo. United for Action has been working with Frack Action Water Defense on putting together a press event here in New York City, because we're going to be taking out a tanker of New York City water that comes from our watershed to Dimock, Pennsylvania. So we're going to be having a press event at City Hall this Tuesday, the 6th, at 9:30 in the morning here in New York City. And then we're all going to travel out to Dimock, Pennsylvania for a rally and a water delivery to the affected folks there who have had their water poisoned and have had the Pennsylvania DEP has turned their backs on them. And so it's been a major rallying cry that, we want to highlight the fact that New York City's water is still safe right now. For today, it's still safe. It may not be if the governor and the DEC continue to move forward. But we are going to, while we still have safe water, we're going to be bringing it out to the residents of Dimock who no longer have safe drinkable water, and trying to call awareness to the kind of poisoning. I mean, we have 11 families on Carter Road that have, lost their water. Talk about a cautionary tale. We have to keep doing things to keep trying to call awareness, and we hope Governor Cuomo is listening.
I want to encourage our listeners to go to your website, unitedforaction.org, because this is where you can have listeners, your voices heard. It's the easiest place to just set up. They have everything set up for you with guidelines in terms of how you can give written feedback to the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation guidelines, and let the governor know and the environmental regulatory body know what you'd like to see. The guidelines themselves are almost like a Bible. They're kind of hard to get through. There have been a couple of different organizations that have digested some of the high and low points, which you can also check out, CatskillMountainkeeper.org and CatskillCitizens.org and DamascusCitizens.org have some excellent analyses. And then you can go back to United for Action with their terrific letter writing campaign and make your own voice heard about your specific concerns. And you can feel free to provide a lot of information, because anything provided they have to go through. In addition, United for Action really is kind of a central focal point for all the actions and events that are upcoming that you can go to. And I highly, highly recommend that you check it out on an ongoing basis, because there's always a new one for people who want to get more involved. And the Water Action is being sponsored by Water Defense. Every week on this show and this e-zine and in my blogs, I feature all of the different grassroots groups, and you can sign up at healthjournalistblog.com for regular, weekly, but not too frequent announcements. If you want to know more and really be part of the action, you can sign up at unitedforaction.org. There's really a lot of ways to participate at any level that you can and that you want to, and I urge you to do it. David, it's been a tremendous pleasure to have you on the show. I hope we can have you on again, actually. actually.
I very much appreciate you having me on. Thank you so much, Allison.
Yeah, thank you for being with us and keeping us informed, and we'll have you back again if you can find the time to keep our listeners up to date on this ongoing movement to really make our society and our country what it needs to be. Thank you, listeners, for being with us this week on Connect the Dots. Next week's show, we're going to be featuring the filmmakers of The Big Fix, and I also hope to have Greg Palast and his new book, Vulture's Picnic, on in coming weeks. So stay tuned every Saturday at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Connect the Dots.